This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Disobedience is the story of the struggle to save the world. That's a first line from the synopsis of a new film. But the film is not science fiction. It's a film about this particular moment in the history of civilization on this planet. Disobedience tells the David versus Goliath tales of frontline leaders around the world risking life and limb in the fight for a livable planet. From the Philippines to Canada, the movement is led by regular people fed up with the power and the pollution of the fossil fuel industry. The film tells a story of four communities preparing to participate in Break Free from Fossil Fuels actions in May of this year. In our backyard, that is a flotilla next weekend that will target the Kinder Morgan facility on Burrard Inlet. We've reached the film's director, Kelly Nikes, in Brooklyn, New York. He's also directed the film Requiem for the American Dream, and he's artist in residence at Harvard University. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
It's really our pleasure. Why did you decide to make this film now?
I think that there are a whole host of benchmarks that we are blindly hurtling past. In March of last year, we passed 400 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. Every scientist has agreed that 350 parts per million is the maximum that we can allow in the atmosphere if we want to have the conditions in which civilization developed, i.e., how it is that we've learned to live, work together, grow the crops that we need to sustain life, and participate in our communities. We are now at 400 parts per million. That is the first time that has happened in 100 million years. And what is our reaction to that? Our reaction to that is Paris of last year, where we get a treaty that fails on two critical fronts. One, that in the last minute, John Kerry said to the French host, there's a word in here that will not allow the United States, the President, or myself, the Secretary of State, to sign this document. And that word was shall. And he forced its replacement with the word should. Now, that seems like it might be a semantical difference, but it has huge legal repercussions. Anybody who's listening to this will understand that when you go from shall to should, you become non-binding. It's no longer a legal contract in which I say, I will build this house for you. And then there's an agreement. If I fail to do so, then there are repercussions. There are enforcement mechanisms. If I say, I should build this house for you, you don't have any legal recourse if I decide to change my mind. So first of all, it's non-binding. That's obviously critically important, but what's more important is that every scientist that has looked at the document for the CO2 emissions that all the nations have agreed to, the 173 signatory nations, it puts us on a path of warming of the surface of the Earth of 2.7 to 3.5 degrees Celsius. That is a world of climate catastrophe that we don't want to live in, and we certainly should be shamed to have that be what it is that we bequeath to generations yet to come. That is a world that is consumed by drought, by the collapse of crop production, by mass dislocation of population. And we've already seen with a small movement of migrants from Syria due to the civil war there into Europe, how poorly prepared we are for these types of migrations. Now just imagine when you have 270 million people around the world, the most heavily fortified border in the world, between Bangladesh and India. There are 10 to 15,000 soldiers on full alert 24/7 at that border. Why? Because India knows that the second that the sea levels begin to rise meaningfully, all those citizens of Bangladesh are going to be flooding into India. They're already prepared. And that is not the type of future I think that any of us want to live in, or is it one that we want to leave to our children and our children's children?
Now, I mentioned, Kelly, in my introduction that there will be an action here at the Kinder Morgan facility in Metro Vancouver, and I want to dig into that in a bit more depth in a moment, but what are some of the other stories that the film sets out to tell?
Well, what the film does, and thank you for giving us a moment to talk about it and giving a platform to share it with a broader audience. What the film does is it's called Disobedience, and what it does is it normalizes civil disobedience. It takes it out of the contemporary realm of understanding in which when we think of civil disobedience, we think of a Starbucks-stomping anarchist. And that's not what the case is at all. What we're talking about is concerned mothers and fathers, politicians, retired politicians, scientists, engineers, teachers, people from all walks of life who are standing together in solidarity for a livable future and basically saying coal, oil, and gas has to stay in the ground if we want to have any shot at avoiding climate catastrophe. Now, some of these stories are most remarkable because they're not from where it is you expect these stories to come. For example, we were in Izmir, Turkey, which is in the Adyar region, and it is just absolutely choked with pollution. It's known as the industrial region. The pollution there is so bad that in an effort to put a green face on what it is they're doing, the energy companies plant trees next to the perimeter of their energy plants. And these trees have to be placed every 2 years because they die so quickly from the extent of the pollution there. And the people banding together there are being led by three retired mayors who in 1989 constructed the largest climate demonstration in Turkish history by forming an unbroken human chain in protest to the proposal of a Japanese corporation's power plant in that region. And they formed a human chain unbroken from the capital of the region to the proposed site that was over 60 kilometers long with more than 50,000 people participating in that. There's this wonderfully rich, deep tradition of people standing together against the power structure to ensure that things that are detrimental and pernicious to their community aren't enacted. And they were successful, very much in the same way that the flotilla of Shell No that took place in Seattle. Shell then abandoned its Arctic drilling. Now, they will obviously say, listen, this was made for certain budgetary reasons and there are strategic objectives that we don't share with the general public, which is why if that happens. But let's be honest, that flotilla changed the conversation, and there's the same opportunity to do so in Vancouver next week, and that gives me hope.
Now, in Canada, First Nations have been on the front lines of the fossil fuel industry, both in terms of the impact on them and their traditional territories, and in terms of major resistance to it. They're definitely on the front lines. You interviewed Reuben George of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation.
That's right. And the thing is, when you see what it is, the choices, the integrity that's being used to make some of these choices, you just have to be, you can't but not admire the courage and the bravery of some of these frontline leaders. And Reuben specifically, there was an opportunity, and they even had politicians saying to them, you have an opportunity here to negotiate. Kinder Morgan wants your land. You can negotiate. They pay out very, very handsomely. That's part of the power of the most wealthy industry that the world has ever seen, is that they have the financial resources to turn people. And what happens is when they meet the immovability of the conviction and the integrity of someone like Reuben, who says, yes, we need that money. Yes, we have people in our community who are living in poverty, and we can help lift them out of poverty, but we can't be bought. That price is too high to lose our land, to lose who we are, to lose where we're from. You can't buy that from us. We will fight it every way that we can. And in the film, Marshall Gans, who's a legendary organizer, he's at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and he organized United Farm Workers, and he organized in the South for civil rights. And he tells the story of David and Goliath in the film. And one of the things that he talks about is the empowering thing of civil disobedience is that you don't look up to authority for the permission to access resources. You don't use power's tools. You use your own resources. You find your pebbles. You're not there with a knife and a sword and a shield and a spear. You're with the resources that you have at your hands. When he spoke about civil rights, he said the empowering thing of the Selma bus boycott was the fact that they didn't look up, they looked down. And they walked. And it doesn't come without pain, and it doesn't certainly come without sacrifice, but it's possible. And that's what they're showing with the First Nation conviction and strengthening of that community. When you all stand together, there's also the ancillary benefit of the fact that it binds you closer as a family, that it brings you together in that community. And it has this very strong, positive, reinforcing effect, particularly in an era that we live that is so virtualized and where we see communities so often fractured. When we stand together with that sense of solidarity, there's such a wonderful community strengthening benefit that comes from that. That isn't often remarked, but I think is very important to point out.
Our studios are a few hundred meters from Burrard Inlet in Vancouver. And one of the actions that you're profiling in the film is a flotilla next weekend that's going to target the Kinder Morgan facility on that inlet further up to the east. What's the connection between the film and these events?
The film brings to a broader audience what it is that's taking place. Part of what civil disobedience is about making a public statement. When Henry David Thoreau, in the first act of civil disobedience, refused to pay tax and was thrown in jail as a consequence because he didn't believe in the future of slave law and he didn't believe in the war against Mexico. And so he removed his participation in that in a meaningful way by refusing to pay taxes. And Emerson comes and sees him in jail. When he's standing there, and Emerson says to him, and I still find it such a challenging remark because it really forces you to look at the decisions that you make every day and take stock of where you stand on the side of history. But Emerson says to Thoreau, David, what are you doing in there? To which Thoreau replies, without skipping a beat, the question isn't what am I doing in here, the question is what are you doing out there? And I think that what we're trying to do with the film is introduce what these actions are to a broader audience so that they have a clearer picture of what's at stake and why these actions are being undertaken. I would want to avoid that somebody sees a snippet of a soundbite on a news program and thinks that you have suddenly these radicalized environmentalists who are just engaging in activism for the sake of engaging in activism. That's not the case at all. We are standing in the shadows and carrying on the beautiful tradition of Gandhi and King, where King famously said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And I think that's important for us to remember, to recall, and to remind each other that it doesn't bend towards justice without the pressure of the people. And yep. I think that this is the opportunity to share those stories of people standing together in solidarity to ensure that that arc bends towards justice ultimately.
Civil disobedience is one particular response to the emergency of climate change. What's the importance of that specific tactic?
I think that's a crucial point to address. Bill McKibben, who wrote the first book for a general population on anthropogenic climate change called The End of Nature, and he's also one of the co-founders of 350.org, who do just wonderful work on climate. He said in the film, points out explicitly, this is not the first tool that you should reach for, and if you use it too often, like any tool, it becomes blunt. But it is important. And I think that if we look back at the significant victory that was Keystone in the United States, civil disobedience played an important role in that. Bill was one of those, along with Jim Hansen, along with Robert Kennedy, along with Naomi Klein. There were people who got arrested for protesting at the White House. That was an important public statement. When Jim Hansen, the former director of the Goddard Institute at NASA and the most renowned climatologist that we have, when he gets arrested, needless to say, that makes headlines. When Michael Broome, the head of the who was the director of the Sierra Club at the time, when he gets arrested, for the first time the Sierra Club in its history endorsed civil disobedience, that makes headlines. But what we should not forget is the fact when the State Department went out to Grand Island, Nebraska, and did public commentary for or against Keystone XL, they had to hold hearings until 11 o'clock that night because of the surge of people who came out to express their vociferous repudiation of Keystone XL. All those people who showed up were part of that broad coalition. coalition of action, as well as the million plus signatures that went into the State Department when they released their environmental impact assessment, which was deeply, deeply flawed. It was all the online support and people making sure that they let their representative know. It is one part of a broad range of actions. And I always think about my sister in instances like this. And actually, my mother's from the Pacific Northwest, and I hold that area with great warmth and fondness because of my American family from there. I'm half Dutch, half American, but also because of its just gorgeous natural splendor. But if I think of my sister in these instances, my sister has, she's progressive, she cares about climate, she has two children who she loves very much, but she doesn't have the capacity or the time to be able to go and engage in an act of civil disobedience that might take her away from her family for 3 days. I think that we all in life have to recognize that people are able to invest what they can, and we should meet them where they are. We shouldn't expect everybody to be able to drop everything and go and engage in these acts when that's unrealistic. That expectation is actually an unjust expectation. We still have many places that we can plug in, that we can apply our talents and sensibilities and employ our energies to help further the movement. It doesn't and shouldn't only be civil disobedience. It's that broad array of action. Not everybody participated in the Selma boycott, but everybody was behind the idea of equality and justice that came from the civil rights movement. As long as you are an advocate, as you're an ally who's supporting the general mission, you will find the place that you can plug in. It doesn't always have to be the same as somebody else's. But as long as we're all moving towards the movement, I think that's the right direction.
Kelly, when you and I spoke earlier today, I learned there are plans to expand the film's project. Can you talk about what's in the works and why you're doing that?
Absolutely. The thing that we discovered very early on was that these stories are incredibly rich, and they all warrant the telling. They warrant the telling, very importantly, also because you and I enjoy pretty robust civil liberties. There's some in this country who don't. And there are others in this country who do, and the same thing in Western Europe. But there are certain expectations that we have when we engage in these types of acts. That isn't always the case, and I think it's important to share these stories because, A, we need to protect those people who are engaging in places where they don't have robust civil liberties, like the Philippines. On March 28th, 6,000 farmers blockaded a highway because they had suffered one of the worst droughts on record, and as a consequence, the rice crop had collapsed, and they were petitioning the government for 15,000 bags of rice to feed their families because they were starving. After 3 days of peaceful demonstrations, police and armed forces moved in on the crowd and opened fire with live ammunition, killing 3 farmers and wounding dozens. Now, we don't expect that to happen in the United States, or at least it hasn't happened in recent memory. But when you see innocent farmers demonstrating peacefully for bags of rice getting shot in the street, that's where we have a moral obligation and responsibility to share those stories and to share them broadly. So disobedience has expanded into a series. The first episode is the one that's online. It introduces us to these different stories. It introduces us to the rich tradition of civil disobedience. That is at watchdisobedience.com. Tonight I'm actually leaving to go back to Germany, where we're going to be covering the Ende Gelände action, which is looking to cease the activities of an open-pit lignite coal mine, which is just some of the dirtiest stuff that you can possibly call coal. And it's Germany. Germany is the largest, in absolute terms, producer of lignite coal in the world, beyond India, beyond China. And while they seem to have a very green, public-facing perception of their activities, everybody thinks about renewables and sustainability when we think about Germany. They are the producer of the largest amount of lignite in the world, and it's the dirtiest stuff that you can imagine. So we're going to be covering that action because it's inspiring, it's exciting, it's necessary, and it's personal, deeply personal, because they're using eminent domain to expand this lignite coal mine and evicting people from their homes. And in the most ironic twist that you could imagine, they're looking to evict people from a town called Prushim, and we feature this in the first episode, where they're using eminent domain to evict people from a town that runs exclusively on sustainable and renewable energy sources to the point that they're actually a net contributor to the grid. And as Tazio says in the film, this is literally the path consuming the future. So we're expanding it into a series, and part of that series, needless to say, in the independent production, one of the things that we're asking for is people like the series to help tell the story, because we're going to be launching a crowdfunding campaign so that we can continue the work and continue to tell these stories. And all of that, both the pilot, the first episode, that is on watchdisobedience.com. And the wonderful thing about that, and 350 is an incredible partner in this, is that if you go to that site and you click join a screening, you'll see that there's screenings from Afghanistan to Alaska to Argentina. They're all over the world. We just found out about a screening that's happening in Tanzania. But you'll see a map there, and you can on that map find out if there's a screening in your neighborhood. Or if there isn't, then there's a very, very user-friendly house party screening kit that has a discussion guide. The film is there available for download, and you can watch the film with friends and family and colleagues in your neighborhood. So it's very friendly. It's the same way that we released Disruption, to which Disobedience is the sequel. Disruption was released in September of 2014 in support of the People's Climate March, which was the largest climate change demonstration in history in New York, when 500,000 people flooded the streets. And Disobedience is the escalation of that movement, the deepening of the commitment in activism across the board.
Well, Kelly, it's been a real pleasure talking to you this morning, and I really appreciate all the work you're doing. It's a huge project, and it's the most important movement right now.
Well, Lorraine, thank you for giving us a moment to be able to talk about it. I encourage all your listeners to have a watch of the film, and I encourage them to participate, support the flotilla that's happening, and I find it inspiring, I find it empowering, and I think it's what gives us hope. And I think that's critical given the grim, grim headlines that we're reading so often, that this really is a bright star in a dark horizon.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Kelly Nikes. You can watch the film Disobedience and help fund the series at watchdisobedience.com. To learn about Break Free and the upcoming action next weekend in Vancouver, you can go to breakfree2016.org. And of course, Kelly Nikes is the director of the film Disobedience.